Please take your Bibles and turn to 1 Samuel chapter 15. And we'll begin our reading at verse 17. 1 Samuel chapter 15, beginning at verse 17. Let's stand for the reading of God's word. And Samuel said, "When thou wast little in thine own sight, wast thou not made head of the tribes of Israel? And the Lord anointed thee king over Israel? And the Lord sent thee on a journey and said, Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they be consumed. Wherefore then hast thou not obeyed the voice of the Lord, but didst fly upon the spoil, and didst evil in the sight of the Lord? And Saul said unto Samuel, Yea, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord, and have gone the way that the Lord sent me, and have brought Agag, the king of the Amalekites, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took the spoil, sheep and oxen, the chief of the things, which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice unto the Lord thy God in Gilgal. And Samuel said, Hath the Lord his great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices, as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because thou hast rejected the word of the Lord, he hath also rejected thee from being king." And the Lord bless the reading of his word. You may be seated. Now, I do plan on preaching an Easter message next week, but today we're going to continue with our study of the book of Judges. If you would please turn to Judges chapter 14. Now last time, Samson was had taken a course that would seem to undermine God's purpose for his life. And sometimes we can do that in our lives. Sometimes we can disqualify ourselves from a place of service. Not all service, but some things. We might struggle to see how God is going to bring about the planned result in the life of Samson. And in spite of himself, however, Samson will be God's tool. That's one of the remarkable things about this particular character, is that God is going to use him in spite of himself. And in this situation, seemingly unrelated things are going to come together to bring about the situation that God has planned. Now remember, let's evaluate Samson. Samson is a passionate, loose cannon who most of the time gets his way. He will be the one-man army that God will use to begin to deliver Israel from Philistine domination. But Samson at present, I'm going to get these names all mixed up. Samson at present, and repeatedly during his lifetime, as we look at the next several chapters, will be his own worst enemy. So often that's the case in our own lives. We are our own worst enemies so often. It seems that he has an utter disregard for his Nazirite vow that God placed him under even before his birth. Now, the Nazirite vow is there in Numbers chapter 6. We've talked about this a little bit, but let me give a brief review. Number one, he was to abstain from touching dead things. Somebody say, well, that sounds good and easy. For a guy, it's not as easy. You know, guys, you know. But he would break his Nazirite vow if he touched the carcass of an unclean animal. This doesn't mean he couldn't eat meat. He could eat the flesh of a clean animal, but he couldn't touch the body of a human being or of an unclean animal. He'd have to have somebody else empty the mousetrap. I'm sorry, it's just the way it is. And so he couldn't do that. By the way, clean animals are animals that have a cloven hoof, have feet like this, and chew the cud. So things like goats, cattle, sheep, deer, antelope. But he couldn't touch the dead body of a horse. That's not a clean animal. It doesn't have a cloven hoof. He couldn't touch a pig. He couldn't touch a dead cat or a mouse. Couldn't touch any of those things. It would break his Nazirite vow. So he couldn't touch anything that was dead. He was to refrain from eating or drinking anything from grapes. It isn't just wine. He couldn't eat raisins. He couldn't have grapes. He couldn't have any of those things. And he was to never cut his hair. Now that's the one that he seems to be, as we get into this, that's going to be the thing that he's most careful about. The other things he doesn't seem to have any regard for. Now, you say, why all these weird things? From our perspective, they're weird. But 3,000 years ago, this was an outward sign of what was supposed to be his dedication to God. People could look at this guy and see that he was a Nazarite by his appearance because of the hair, which was usually up in braids and so on. And then also, there were certain things of his behavior that separated him from other people and from certain behaviors. And it was an outward sign of his dedication to God's purpose for his life. But Samson, even though this was imposed on him, this is what God said he was to be. But Samson is far more interested in what he wants than what God wants. And sometimes that's the case for God's children. We sometimes get distracted from the primary thing. It's wrong, it's sin. And yet we sometimes pursue that anyway. And in our text, he is pursuing marriage with a Philistine girl. Now these people, the Philistines, were the oppressors of God's people. They were the oppressors of the Israelites. They worshipped gods made of stone. And most of all, God had forbidden such relationships. His people were not to intermarry with the idolatrous people around them. And that was declared in the law of Moses. It's very clear. We mentioned this, I think we read the text last time. It's in at least two places. But God is setting the stage for Samson to begin to deliver Israel. Samson is oblivious. I want you to understand this. This is true in our own lives. God is not. God always knows what he's doing. And sometimes it seems like I can't see how God can possibly turn the present circumstances into a situation where he will be glorified by it. And yet he does over and over and over again. And we'll see that here today. Now, a little background. We talked about this last time. Samson lives in Zorah, Z-O-R-A-H, which is an Israelite town of the tribe of Dan. And it is right on the border of the Philistine territory. He was down in Timnah, 4 miles away, and he saw this girl. And the poor guy got Twitterpated. I mean, he just was totally... It said she looked good to him. There is no indication. Matter of fact, there's some indication that he had not talked to her. We don't even know if they made eye contact. He just saw her and went, "Whoa! I want that. I want that." It's like driving past the car lot. I want that. And so he comes home and he tells his parents, "Get me that girl." And of course, his parents exploded. This is a Philistine. These are the oppressors. These are idolaters. Aren't there, out of the thousands and thousands in Israel, couldn't you find a girl there? Instead, you've got to go to these pagan idolaters who hold our God in contempt. And Samson, through gritted teeth, said, "Get her for him. She pleases me well." I mentioned also that Samson doesn't, for all this to come to pass, Samson doesn't, because he's empowered by God. He's not empowered by Gold's Gym. And so he doesn't have to be some huge mountain of a man, but I suspect he was. He doesn't have to be. And some of the things that he's going to do as we go through his life are things that absolutely, positively were supernaturally done. They are not physically possible. I don't care how big and strong you are, the human frame is incapable under natural circumstances to be able to deal with some of the things that Samson did. He is supernaturally empowered. But I also suspect that he was a giant of a man. That's our setting. And so in verse 5 of chapter 14, "Then went Samson down and his father and his mother to Timnath." They're going to make the arrangements for the wedding. Remember, at this day and age, and frankly throughout most of human history, the young people are not involved in this. The parents get together and work out the details. And we have a little bit of that today, that if you're dealing with the traditional setup in our American culture and so on, that the bride's family pays for the wedding and the groom's father or family pays for the rehearsal dinner, and there's certain things that the families take care of and the kids are just along for the ride and other people get to foot the bill. It's a great setup, isn't it? And And so the parents are making the arrangement. Samson goes along with them. And it says, he came to the vineyards of Timnath, and behold, a young lion roared against him. Now, we're going to find out later, his parents didn't know what was going on. So they had evidently, they'd left Zora probably together, close to the same time, but they took different routes to get to the location. And so he's taking a cross-country route, and they're probably taking the main road. And as he's cutting through, a young lion roared against him. It's not meowing. Don't think of young lion. Think of young lion. Big enough so that the lion is going to look and say, look at a human being and say, oh boy, lunch. And so, by the way, lions, used to be very common in the Middle East. Lions, you know, you grow up thinking, oh, lions, that's African safari stuff. There are still Asian lions in existence today. There are still, several prides of lions in India. And lions used to be found at this time, this was a little over 3,000 years ago. They were found from India all the way to South Africa and also still found in Greece and Turkey and places like that. Lion used to be, had the widest range of any mammal on earth at one point in history. And so, this lion comes up and roars against him, and we think, well, that's the end of Samson. We hear about cougar attacks here in the Northwest from time to time, and a good-sized male cougar has no trouble taking out a human being. And this animal here is probably bigger than the biggest cougars that we have in the state. And it says in verse 6, the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. The idea there in the original language is that it rushed upon him, just overwhelmed him. And he rent him or tore him as he would have torn a kid. You say, what in the world? The lion springs, Samson grabs him. As I did some reading, this changed my vision of this. Okay, let's, instead of looking at this as a gruesome thing, as far as tearing a kid, think of this as, you go to Costco or Fred Meyer or whatever, and you buy the whole rotisserie chicken. And, at my house, one of those is a snack for my son. And if it's been sitting there for a day or so in the refrigerator, you can go to the refrigerator and you grab the drumstick and do you go get the kitchen shears and the knife and saw that thing off? What do you do? At least I know what we do at my house. Snap it off. All right. If you have a whole roasted lamb or something like that, you can if it's all cooked, you could pull it apart the same way. That's what he's talking about. He took this lion and tore him to bits as if it were a roasted lamb. And it says there was no weapon in his hands. All he had was these. There is no indication before this that Samson had ever done something like this. Now, it's possible that he was known for amazing strength and so on before. It's possible. But here we have the first record of his God giving him supernatural strength. And he took a lion, probably a cat weighing over 200 pounds, and just sort of shredded it with his bare hands. And here's the amazing thing. To me, okay, here, understand that Samson is 19, 20, 21 years of age here at this time. And to me, the most remarkable thing is not that he killed the lion with the bare hands. It's what he didn't do. It says in verse 6, and he had nothing in his hands, and he told not his father or his mother what he had done. He didn't tell anybody. I mean, good grief. If I had, man, let me tell you what happened to me. This is just amazing. And it would become the story that people, after a while, would just go, yes, we've heard this before. And again, and again, and again, and again, and again. It would just have this never-ending story. I got to tell you, this is the most amazing thing. He doesn't tell anybody. And he goes on his way, and he arrives at Timnath. He went down, verse 7, and he talked with the woman. Oh, they actually talk. And his feelings haven't changed. She pleased Samson well. All right, so going from Zora down the long hill, remember there's about a 1,500 foot difference in elevation between these two places, even though it's only four miles. They go down from Zora to Timna. He takes the shortcut through the vineyards, has the encounter with the lion, kills the lion with his bare hands, and then continues on to Timna as if nothing had happened, and obviously didn't damage his clothes or scratch up his arms or anything. And it was done. And he rendezvous with his parents. They make the arrangements. He begins to interact with the girl, and they chalk and so on, and the arrangements are made. Now, between the time of the arrangements and the time of the actual wedding, in a Middle Eastern setting like this, you can have anywhere from 3 months to a year, sometimes even longer. So when we go from verse 7 to verse 8, don't think this was, you know, like a few days later. This was months and months and months later. And after a time, so again, three to 12 months, probably somewhere in the middle, he returned to take her. All right, so we're going to go down. We're actually going to have the wedding. Now, they don't have the organist playing march or something, and everybody stands up and looks back as the father brings the girl in her white dress and everything else, and then who gives this and all that other stuff that we do in our weddings. What they do is it was normally at the groom's house. But we're dealing with a cross-cultural thing, and so the Philistine family is hosting this. This is at the bride's home. And they have a party. Oh, they have the reception first. Well, sort of. In this particular case, it lasts for 7 days. If you think today's weddings are expensive. By the way, I read the average wedding in America today is, $30,000? Damn, it's going to be cheaper than that, I'm telling you. No plans, by the way, just letting you know. And so they would have party, and there would be wine, there would be food, there would be games and entertainment, there would be all these things. And then they hosted them, they lodged them, they took care of the whole thing for a week. This goes on. I think personally myself, I think it'd get kind of tedious, but that's just me. He returned to take her, and he turned aside. He's on his way, and he says, "Oh, that's right." Because he still hasn't told anybody. And he goes and takes a peek to see if it's still there. To see the carcass of the lion. And behold, there was a swarm of bees and honey in the carcass. Now that's very odd. Bees, honeybees are very clean. They're very particular. Wasps, hornets, they'll be in there eating carrion. But the bees, honeybees are pretty clean animals. Now, if you are dealing, this might be supernaturally provided for, because this is going to all tie together with God's providence and bring about the situation. However, if you want to look at it from how would the bees do this, consider a Middle Eastern summer. Months have gone by. The jackals, the vultures have had their time with the lion. And what you've got is perhaps a rib cage with stretched, dried up hide still hanging on it. All right? And it's taut and crunchy and crispy. Not that you're wanting to eat this, but you get the idea. And so in this tent, the bees have built a hive. And so he comes across this thing, and it says, he took thereof with his hands. The idea is there is he scraped the honey out from inside the carcass. Now, again, remember, this is dry and probably mostly bone. But he's scraping out the honey. He took the honey. Now, we wouldn't think, well, it's an odd situation, but hey, honey. And I remember one time there was when I was a kid growing up, there was a big transformer box, great big huge one, size of a refrigerator. And there was a honeybee hive inside this thing. And the lineman's up there. Larry would have loved this. Was in a bee suit while he was doing this. And he's up there, and he's got big huge scrapers, and he's pulled the thing out and scraping all this stuff out. And I tell you what, there was a lot of kids that came by later, and we're gathering up the combs and other stuff that was lying on the ground. And so he took the honey, but he still doesn't tell anybody because he hasn't told anybody about the lion. And he goes on down to Timnah, and it says, and he came to his father and his mother, and he gave them, and they did eat. So the three of them are eating some of this honey that he has gathered. But it says that he didn't tell them that he had taken the honey out of the carcass of a lion. Why? Why didn't he tell his parents? All right, ceremonially unclean. He's breaking his Nazirite vow by touching the carcass. Not necessarily the killing of the lion, but the touching of the carcass later. And his parents would also be, under Jewish law, ceremonially unclean. How do you fix this? You take a bath, and then the next evening you're good to go. It's a ceremonial thing. But he doesn't tell them. Because, number one, he has no regard for the situation in the first place. But also, he doesn't want to hear the lecture. Samson, don't you know? And he's probably heard this over and over and over again because, again, he doesn't seem to have any regard for this. He doesn't tell his parents. Now, the ignorance of his parents that he hasn't told anybody, not even his parents, is going to tie in with what we see following. It says in verse 10, so his father went down unto the woman, and Samson made there a feast, for so used the young men to do. All right, so we're going to have the wedding feast, and it's going to last for a week. And it came to pass when they saw him that they brought 30 companions to be with him. This is very, very interesting. Normally, a groomsman, even in this day, provides his own groomsman. All right. When my wife and I got married, the bridesmaids were a bunch of her friends, and I had my friends come to stand with me. All right. Her folks didn't get together and pick out some guys that they knew to stand up there with me. All right. I brought mine. She brought hers. All right. That's normally how it was done, even in Bible times. In this, but this time, the Philistines provide for him, if you want to look at it this way, and they provide 30. 30. Now, Samson is hosting, he's providing for the feast. It's going to be at the bride's house, but he's providing for this. So, evidently there's some means there, but why the 30 Philistine companions? There's been a number of people that thought, and I think maybe rightly so, that they weren't there just to be his buddies for the wedding. They were there to be his guards. All right, you've got this fella who maybe he looks intimidating. Maybe he is this great big, and plus he's an Israelite. And this is the first recorded incident that we're going to be seeing here, but who knows, there may have been some other things, but I think that this is probably the first one. But I think there was some regard for this, that this was not a goodwill gesture. This was, we don't necessarily trust this guy. He's on our home turf. Maybe this is the local militia that had been recruited. Maybe this is the local military post there in Timnah. But whatever the case may be, there were 30 companions brought with him, and they're Philistines. So here you have an Israelite at a Philistine party that he's paying for. And Samson said unto them, verse 12, now remember, entertainment and games and stuff were part of this. Not necessarily pin the tail on the donkey, but you get the idea. Samson said unto them, I will now put forth a riddle unto you. And if he can certainly declare it to me within the seven days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 sheets or 30 changes of garments. I'll give you undergarments, which was basically a t-shirt that hit you just above the knees, a sleeveless t-shirt that hit you just above the knees, and then the outer robe that they wore. I'll give you 30 of those things, one set of those for each of you. And if you can't, then you guys corporately provide me with 30. So the burden is on Samson. This is going to cost Samson a whole lot more than it's going to cost the Philistines. They're thinking, hey, this is a good deal, and we've got 7 days to figure this thing out, and there's 30 of us, so we can pool our thinking and keep our eyes peeled and listen and talk this up, and we should be able to make. So they said, yeah, let's do this. He says, if you can't, then I'll give you the same. And they said, put forth the riddle that we may hear. Let's go for it. And he says in verse 14, out of the eater came forth meat, and out of the strong came forth sweetness. And they could not in 3 days expound the riddle. They're sitting there thinking about it. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. Now, the answers to these things are very plain once they're explained. But here's the key thing. There's no witnesses to this situation. Even his parents don't know. And you can imagine, after several days, these guys are getting a little anxious and beginning to think, this is really going to cost us. I gotta buy this guy a set of clothes. Now, clothes in Bible times were expensive. Everything is hand woven, hand cut, hand sewn. Everything's made by hand. I mean, down to the, you just spun the thread. Alright, clothing was expensive. I can run up to the men's warehouse and I can buy a suit off the, yeah, I can't buy one off the rack. I'm not proportioned properly, but I can buy a suit up there for, probably $400 or less. In corresponding money, it's going to cost probably double that. And so we're talking about a pretty expensive venture, which the Philistines originally thought we got this. And after the days go by, they're beginning to think, man, this is not good. And so they're going to do something. They hear the riddle. It came to pass on the seventh day. We get down to the end of this thing. They had probably tried several different things, asking around. And they said to Samson's wife, entice thy husband that he may declare unto us the riddle. And then they threaten her. They said, lest we burn thee and thy father's house with fire. We're not talking about the home. We're talking about the household. Burn the people with fire. We're going to take you out and burn you guys alive if you don't get this, if you don't help us here. Have you not called us to take that we have? Is it not so? You brought us here to rip us off. You're part of this. You're part of the problem. So you find out the answer and tell us so that we can tell him. Otherwise, we're going to kill you and your family. Oh, this is a fun party. And so the festivities, which after the giving of the riddle, have deteriorated into some anger and some frustration. Now, I will tell you this. As the feelings begin to deteriorate, and as the 30 companions become more and more hostile, there's probably one guy who's smiling and really enjoying this, and that's Samson. Because he probably doesn't really have a whole lot of love for these 30 guys. He doesn't know these guys. He probably is a sharp enough character so he knows why they're there. And he has gotten them where he wants them. He's taking advantage of them. And they're stuck and they're frustrated and he knows it. And he's probably, yeah, I love this. But I don't suspect that he knows about the threat. Remember, he's a capable guy. And we're gonna make the party even more pleasant. Verse 16. And Samson's wife wept before him and said, thou
bitterness, but hate me and lovest me not. Thou hast put forth a riddle unto the children of my people and have not told me. And he's,
and she's going on and on. And he said, I haven't told my mom or dad. Expect me to tell to you. And she wept before him all week long this goes on. Now the threat had been going on. I suspect that she was probably trying to get the answer. Number one, she first was out of curiosity. And then as the thing went on, she's looking at the guys are becoming more and more hostile, and she's thinking, I've got to remedy this situation. But this has been a really unpleasant week. He's there for a party, and the festivities have become rather hostile. Every time he's in the presence of the bride, all she does is blubber and cry and nag him. Boy, great expectations. This is going to be a great marriage. I can hardly wait. Here we are, the wedding feast, and all she does is nag me and cry all day long for 7 weeks. Or for 7 days, rather. This is just going to be, I can hardly wait. And so these guys are exasperated. And the party has now become filled with resentment and fear. The girl is terrified, and the men are angry. And Samson is just rolling with it, at least so far. Verse 16, she wept before him and goes through this whole thing. And in verse 17, she wept before him the 7 days, and while the feast lasted, and it came to pass on the seventh day that he told her, because she lay sore upon him. He was nagged nearly to death, is what it is. He told her just to shut her up. At least that's the guy's perspective. And she immediately told the riddle to the children of her people. So he told, she told, and now they told. And the men of the city said unto him, in verse 18, on the seventh day before the sun went down, they're going to wait till the last minute. They've had the answer probably for a little while. They're going to wait till the last possible minute. And they said, what is sweeter than honey and what is stronger than a lion? Okay, there we got the answer. Samson is not a real dim bulb. He may be arrogant. He may be self-willed, but he's not stupid. He may do some stupid stuff. He may allow his passions to gain control, but he's not a dumb guy. And he immediately said, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle. He knows they cheated. And he told them how they cheated. Now, he didn't necessarily know about the threat, but he knew that they got it from the girl. But there's no indication he knew about the threat. By the way, calling his wife a heifer, not real flattering in our day. It wasn't flattering back then either. Probably about the same as it would be today. For those of you who don't know what a heifer is, that's a young cow. And not only that, he has been betrayed. I mean, understand, he's just getting to know this girl. He tells her a secret and she immediately spills the beans at great cost to him. He's been betrayed. That's another sign of a great start. Some of you heard beauty is only skin deep, but ugly goes right to the bone. And she may have been beautiful on the surface, but I think the ugly was under the surface and went right to the bone. It's kind of like some of these beautiful Hollywood starlets and stuff like that. You couldn't give me enough to be married to one of those people. I couldn't even imagine life with one of these people. Just let me run the other way as fast as I can. Doesn't matter what they look like. It's what kind of character do these people have? And evidently this girl has some difficulties in the character department, as we're going to see in a little bit. And so he's got to come up with 30 changes of clothes. Now, again, he's funded the party. It is, he put some things together along the way, and I think his family probably had some resources. But that isn't what he does. In verse 19, it says, the Spirit of the Lord came upon. How is God going to take this self-willed man who has pursued a relationship with a pagan Philistine girl? How is he going to take a wedding feast and turn it into creating open hostility with the Philistine nation? Well, he's going to do that.
He's going to do that. It didn't look like it at the beginning, but he's going to do that now.
It says, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. Same idea of the Spirit rushed upon him. And he went down to Ashkelon. The Philistines have a bunch of little villages and so on, like Timnah. But they have five major cities. It was a pentapolis. Okay, five means, just like you read in the New Testament, you have the Decapolis, that's 10 cities. Pentapolis, five cities. And they were, let me see if I can do this, Gaza, Gath, Ekron, Ashkelon, and... Can't come up with the last one. Begins with an E. I'll come up with it later. On the way home. But Ashkelon was one of the primary cities of the Philistines, and it was also the one that was furthest away from where he was. It's 25 miles southwest of where he is, down on the coast, south of where Gaza is today. Gath was the other way. Gaza, Gath. Ekron, Ashkelon, and Ashkelon. And so he goes the 25 miles down there, and it says that he slew 30 men. He just goes in there, no indication of weapons again, bare hands, kills 30 men, took their spoil, takes their clothes. So he's going 25 miles down, and then he's coming back 25 miles carrying 30 suits. That I have cleaned out my closet at least once in my life. And a lot of clothes are heavy. He's carrying this 25 miles. He kills the guys, probably with his bare hands, takes their clothes, and gave it unto those that had expounded his riddle. Here you go! Now, 25 miles away, maybe they don't know who did it. At least the news hadn't traveled that far that fast. And so there's no immediate repercussions. Immediate. The guys who received the clothes maybe wonder where they came from. Maybe they had a lot of blood stains on them. We don't know. That might be a good indication of things yet to come. But he gives these perhaps damaged and blood-stained clothes to the 30 men. And then it says, and his anger was kindled. The guy was enraged still. And he went up into his father's house. So he's down there in Timnah. Here you go! And he turns and stomps off 4 miles and goes back to his dad's house. And all the people are there in this... Because who was the only outsider there? Samson. His parents had come down, made the arrangements, and then he probably left. They didn't stick around. It says the young men had the party and so on. So here are the 30 young men. There's the bride. There's the bride's family. And they're all there. And the groom has just, in a rage, stomped off back home. And here everybody's holding their clothes. And the groom has left the building. What to do? Well, this is good. This is the final straw that is going to create the big problem that we're going to be looking at here in a couple of weeks. Samson's wife was given to his companion. He had used it. They gave the girl to the best man. In verse 20. Which I suspect was what the girl wanted all along. She doesn't know this guy. And this solves the problem of the cross-cultural relationship. The Philistines were probably all too glad to be done with Samson. And again, the girl probably getting her what she wanted all along. And not only that, the dowry the family still has. Such a deal. They got a party. They got clothes, they got money, and the groom left, and it didn't cost him anything other than a few days of aggravation, as far as they know. Now, in our text, in the passage, the story we just read here, there are no heroes.
There are several passages like that in the Bible where you have a long drawn out narrative, and as you go through this thing, there's no heroes. You know, this, you have the same thing where Isaac and Rebekah and Esau and Jacob, where the deception, they bring the meal in before blind Isaac and so on, and so who's going to get the blessing and everything. You look at that, everybody is either openly disobedient to God, lying or cheating or whatever the case may be. There are no heroes. And yet those kinds of situations, God uses even those things to bring about his purpose. And I mentioned at the beginning that sometimes the characters are oblivious to the purpose of God, or they don't care. But God knows exactly what he's going to do, because God is never out of control. And it doesn't matter how far afield the situation may get to be. If God has made a promise, if God has said something is going to happen, it's going to happen. And it doesn't matter what the situation seems to indicate, that it would be an impossibility. It's still going to happen. God's promises are going to come to pass. We look at the world today, and we have the fulfillment of God's kingdom promises, that he will rule and reign on this earth for 1,000 years in righteousness. And we look at this world and we go, I don't see it coming. By the way, I have decided something extraordinary would have to happen. I have decided that when we're done with Philemon on Sunday nights here in the next week or two, we're going to do Revelation. So I encourage you to be here for that. And I'm also, with the help of other people, I'm hoping to have some PowerPoint. So we'll have some maps and some diagrams and stuff like that to help us along the way. But I'm planning on Revelation starting here at the beginning of May for Sunday nights. So God's purposes are going to come to pass. There are no heroes in our text except perhaps Samson's parents, who got dragged into this against their will, and they're not in there very long. Manipulation and hurt feelings abound all around. But the story is not over. This is the prelude to what's going to follow. The conflict will grow until we see sort of an undeclared war between the Philistines and not Israel as a nation. That was the problem we looked at the beginning. Israel has not been pleading with God to overthrow their oppressors. Instead, Israel is just dealing with the pain. But instead, you're going to have a war between the Philistines and Samson, the one-man army. And God's purposes will come to pass, what God had said would be the case for this boy before he was even conceived. Now, again, we ourselves may be in the fog as far as what God is doing in our lives, but God is not. And then the question to you and to me: are you a willing or unwilling participant in God's plan? Samson has not been a willing participant. He has a purpose. He knows what that purpose is, and he has seemingly contempt for it. Are you a willing or unwilling participant in God's plan for your life? You know what you're supposed to be doing. There's some basic things. God didn't give you a specific saying, okay, before you were born, we knew what you were going to be doing, and you're going to be doing this. Most of us don't have that. Matter of fact, none of us have that. But we do have some basics as far as what we ought to be doing as far as Christian responsibility is concerned. Are we busy doing what we know we're supposed to be doing? Are you a willing or unwilling participant in God's plan for your life? Is God even a part of your personal plans? You have goals, aspirations, desires. You've got plans, what you want to be doing a year from now, 5 years from now perhaps. Goals and dreams. Is God part of that? Because for Samson, God seems to be a very, very distant being. God is still going to use him. God is still going to fulfill his word. But in some ways, it's almost like Samson's being dragged along kicking and screaming. And I strongly suspect that if Samson had been a willing participant in this, greater things would have happened, and the story would have ended much more happily than it will. Are we willing participants in what God has in store for us as individuals? Heavenly Father, thank you for your word. Father, thank you for the reminder that you are always in control. You are always in charge. And Father, you have a plan and you have a purpose, and I believe you have a plan and purpose for each one of us. But Father, you have also told us as your children that there are certain things that we're supposed to do and certain things we're not supposed to do. And frankly, if we're busy doing the things we're supposed to be doing, we're not going to have time really to do the things we're not supposed to. Father, do we regard you in our plans? Do we regard you in our day-to-day goings-on? Are you first and foremost in our thoughts, in our words, in our deeds? Father, may that be the case. May we be willing tools to accomplish the purpose that you have for us. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.